Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Once again, the Trump administration's travel ban targeting majority Muslim countries has been blocked in court, and Donald Trump is, of course, furious. Is ISIS about to be defeated in Iraq as U.S.-backed forces make a final push on Mosul? The humanitarian situation is catastrophic with more than 100,000 people displaced. The Trump administration's budget outline proposes devastating cuts if they get their way. The burden of the huge Pentagon spending increase will fall squarely on the backs of working and poor people in the United States. But first, we turn to the defeat of the Trump administration's travel ban, or its blocking, in court. We are joined by Trina Realmuto. She is an attorney with the National Lawyer Guild's National Immigration Project. Welcome back, Trina.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you. Well, there was another big day in court, both in Hawaii and Maryland. Again, the revised executive order by Donald Trump, what in the campaign he called the Muslim ban, he now says it's just a travel ban on certain countries, but it was found to be deficient enough so that it was blocked with a worldwide blockage by the court in Hawaii. Talk about what the judge decided and why he decided it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the case in Hawaii was brought by the state of Hawaii and an individual. And they allege, like many of the people in, or many of the cases in the courts right now, that there were this second executive order, the second travel ban, suffered from the same discriminatory animus against the Muslim religion, as well as nationals from these six targeted organizations. And they relied on the statements of the president as a candidate, from his advisors, statements from the president himself during since he took office, that all convey in the fact that they wanted, this administration wanted to enact a Muslim ban. And so they made these allegations. They talked about the harm that individuals would suffer, that the universities would suffer, that the state itself would suffer if this ban were to go into effect. And on the 15th, Judge Watson heard oral argument in that case, and he enjoined two key provisions of the executive order. He enjoined the travel ban, which barred entries from individuals from these targeted nations. And he also enjoined or stopped the suspension of our refugee travel program. And he said that this order is going into effect right away, and he asked the parties for further briefing on how long this order should remain in effect. And that's where things are at in Hawaii right now with that case.
The court, and as you said, I believe the plaintiffs made the case that while Trump was arguing that this was a travel ban, meaning it was about national security, and that these formerly seven, now six countries after Iraq was taken off the list following the protest of the Iraqi government, a military ally of the U.S. government in the fight against ISIS in Iraq, that argument about national security was pretextual, that the real thing was it's a Muslim ban with a new sort of iteration. And they quoted the statement of Donald Trump, and I want to read it to the audience, too. Just to remind people, it was December 7, 2015. You could still see it on the Donald Trump, Mike Pence website. Here's the quote. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what is going on. And then there's all kinds of follow-up statements by Trump talking about how so many Muslims hate America and want Sharia law, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, Trump's campaign statements were so blatantly targeting Muslims as Muslims, targeting a religion as a religion, that the court said no matter what he calls it now, it is a Muslim ban, but with just this kind of new sort of national security pretext. Is that right, in essence?
Absolutely. And the judge in Hawaii also took note of the fact that, you know, after the first ban was enjoined and the court, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had said some, you know, identified some problems in the ban, that the lawyers in Washington just went back and tried to, you know, fix those quirks. But, you know, subsequently the administration said this is going to try to do the same thing we were trying to do the first time. And you, in the United States, under the Establishment Clause in the Constitution, you can't do that. You can't disfavor a religion.
Donald Trump says he's furious, that makes America look weak. That's what he told a cheering throng on a campaign-like stop the night before last. He says he's going to go to the Supreme Court. Is this going to go to the Supreme Court? And if you would, I want to just also take note of the fact that there were five justices on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which upheld the original blocking decision by Judge Robarts in Seattle, Washington. These five judges took issue with, they dissented from the decision, and they wrote in this statement, and this comes as, quote, good news for the Trump White House, especially as it anticipates possibly going to the Supreme Court. Quote, this is from the letter of the five justices. The president's actions might have been more aggressive than those of his predecessors, but that was his prerogative. Even if we have questions about the basis for the president's ultimate findings, whether it was a, quote, Muslim ban, close quote, or something else, we do not get to peek behind the curtain. So long as there is one, quote, facially legitimate and bona fide, quote, close quote, reason for the president's action, our inquiry is at an end. In other words, if Donald Trump has one valid, bona fide reason to have such a travel ban, these justices are arguing that's the president's prerogative. We can't look behind the curtain to know for certain anything.
Right. And so, like, just to be clear about what you're reading from and how that's come about, I mean, as you recall, in the first round of litigation here, the government asked the Ninth Circuit to stay the district court's order, the district court's injunction. They went running to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit said, no, this injunction is going to stay in effect. And they denied that government motion to hold things in abeyance. And some judges, a small number of judges, we know that from one of the other concurrences that you didn't read from, and I'll talk about in a second. One of the judges sort of, you know, called for an en banc review, wanted the full court, all of the judges in the Ninth Circuit, to look at this again.
And just real quick, Trina, how many in the Ninth Circuit, how many judges are there so that an en banc, meaning all the judges panel, how many is that?
Well, the Ninth Circuit is one of the largest courts. There's at least 15. I don't have the exact number.
Okay, but it's a large number.
It's a big court, and they took the vote, and they upheld the panel's decision and said no, you know. And one of the judges, and so this decision that you're reading from is like a small group of judges. I mean, there's 15 to 20 judges on the whole panel. They sort of wanted to rule this way, but they didn't have the votes. So the majority of the Ninth Circuit agreed with the panel and agreed with the problems from the first order. And Judge Reinhart also wrote a concurrence saying that, you know, he was proud to be part of this judiciary that respects the constitutional rights of individuals, you know, regardless where they came from, and that is independent of the political process, and that is the judiciary's role here. And so, you know, we've seen now this order come out of the Ninth Circuit. It just means that the case is over, really, at the Ninth Circuit.
So the five judges, who I believe are all Republican appointees,
yes.
So they're a tiny – well, not tiny, but they're a real minority within this large circuit, the Ninth Circuit, which is in the West Coast. They issue this statement, but they lost. They lost at the larger panel said, no, we're not going to have an en banc review, meaning all the judges would review the earlier three-court judge panel that ruled against Trump. But is this letter then sort of a political statement in a way, because if it shows that there's some split, even though there's not technically a split because it's just a letter of dissent, really, it seems like to me, by, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know, you can explain it. But that then allows the Trump administration perhaps to go to the Supreme Court and say, well, look, there's divided legal judgment on this, thus the Supreme Court will hear it. Is that what's coming?
When you have these calls for en banc for the full court to review things, it's not uncommon for judges to say, oh, well, I would have heard this case or I would have heard this issue, and to write such a dissent from an en banc call. It has happened before in other cases, but it is a way of these judges expressing their opinion, and it does give the federal court, the federal government, something to cite to sort of say, oh, but these judges are on our side. That said, they were in the minority. We now have the injunction, a second injunction from Hawaii, from a district court judge, and we also have a district court judge in Maryland who, on the 16th, also enjoined the second executive order. So there's a growing list of district court judges who really delve into this and examine this and who have issued injunctions both for the first executive order and now on the second one. We have not just the district court in Hawaii, but now we have the district court of Maryland as well.
Very good. Trina Realmuto is our guest. She is an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild's National Immigration Project. Trina, talk about your case, the case Ali versus Trump, which, of course, you're awaiting decision. Talk about that.
So our case also is started with the first executive order, and we amended our complaint for the second executive order. Our case deals with people. Our plaintiffs are people who are in the immigrant visa process, which means they are folks who are applying for green cards because they have a family member in the United States, or they have an employer, U.S.-based employer, who want to sponsor them to come work and get their green card in the United States through that employment. And so our case raises the same sort of challenges that we've seen and that are widely talked about in the news about the Establishment Clause, about favoring religion, about being a Muslim ban. But we also focus on a statutory provision where Congress expressly said that there should be no discrimination based on nationality or place of birth or place of residence in the immigrant visa process, in the green card process. And that was sort of born out of the national quota system that we had in the 1920s and after, that Congress said, no more, we're not going to discriminate based on, in this immigrant visa process, based on nationality. And so we are also sort of arguing that this provision has been violated by the terms of the second executive order. And we had a hearing, and at this time we're awaiting decision.
And what will be the bigger impact, or the specific practical and bigger impact of this, of the decision once it comes?
Well, in our case and in all the cases where you see the stop of the executive order, what we're trying to do is to preserve the status quo, to have visa processing for folks from these countries and to have our refugee processing continue as it has continued, as it has been in effect, so that people are not stranded outside the United States, people from these countries and refugees. And so we think that the impact, at least to the lives of the people affected, will be to have them rejoin their family in the United States or come to their jobs in the United States or come to their universities and schools in the United States. So that'll be one big impact. But it's also sort of an impact for folks of us who believe in constitutional rights and believe in access to the court, to have these district courts sort of say that, you know, the statements by the president have expressed a religious animus and that that's not permissible. We're not going to stand for it.
Trina Realmuto, I want to help the audience, the broader audience, especially those who are not Muslim and those who may not be refugees, maybe not from the Middle East, maybe not from other countries. In other words, native-born people here whose parents came many, many, many generations ago, or ancestors, to realize the fear that exists in the United States. I was somewhere at another media outlet not too long ago, and I was talking to people who were producers. Some were Iraqis, some were Iranian, some were Indians, some of them were U.S. citizens. They were all afraid to travel. They were canceling trips back home, even though in this case, one of them was an Iraqi who was a naturalized U.S. citizen, because they're just afraid they're not going to get let back in. I mean, there is a reign of, I don't know, terror or fear that exists amongst immigrant communities as a consequence of this. Will the court rulings provide a kind of reassurance that people will start to feel more comfortable? Or is this, are we in this for the long haul, do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, one would hope that favorable court rulings could provide some temporary, some assurance, right? And we'll see how these cases make their way through the courts. I understand that this concern is about, is sort of pervasive everywhere and goes both ways. I think not just people inside the United States, but people outside the United States are going to say, hey, we don't want to come here because, you know, of these policies that they're hearing about. And so do I think that the courts will provide reassurance? I certainly hope so. I think it's not good for the Trump administration to continue to try to defend these policies, but only time will tell. Right. And so I think people can also take encouragement from unifying with other immigrant communities, with other immigrant advocates and organizations that, you know, care about the rights of immigrants. We've seen an outpouring of people who never really had immigration on their radar, but flocked to the airports because they just in their gut knew that what was happening was wrong. You know, and I hope that we'll see more of that, and we'll see more of that with voters who will, you know, make their voice heard in the next round of, you know, elections.
I hear you, and I agree. We can't just wave a magic wand and dissipate an atmosphere of Islamophobia and xenophobia, because that's really what we're experiencing in these initiatives by the Trump administration are part of it and a catalyst to more of it. But I want to congratulate you and the other attorneys and all the people who have been in the courts and, of course, those who have been in the streets and in the airports trying to uphold basic constitutional rights and basic human rights. We've been talking with Trina Riamuto. She is an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild's National Immigration Project. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Is ISIS or Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, about to be militarily defeated in Iraq? As U.S.-backed forces make a final push on Mosul, the humanitarian situation is catastrophic, with more than 100,000 people displaced. We are joined from Spain by Alberto Garcia Watson, a journalist and former senior Middle East correspondent for Hispan TV. Welcome back, Alberto.
Thank you for having me.
Alberto, tell us about the current situation in Mosul as far as the battle is concerned. On Wednesday, a federal police spokesperson, that is an Iraqi federal police spokesperson, said, quote, "Our troops are making a steady advance and we are now less than 800 meters from the mosque." Close quote. Go ahead.
Well, situation is getting dramatic at this point. It's true. They're actually less than a kilometer away from the very center of Mosul. And this is turning into a tremendous battle where Daesh, ISIL, is using thousands of civilians as human shields, and that's why we have a very, very high percentage of civilian casualties. United Nations has even mentioned that half the casualties in this whole operation, half of them are civilians, and that's due mostly to the use of the terrorists, of the civilians as human shields, and also because of the heavy bombardment that the allies, let's call them the U.S.-led coalition, is inflicting on Mosul. The situation is very precarious at this point, and hundreds of thousands of civilians are becoming refugees. The situation is very dramatic at this point. Thousands of them have died. Hundreds of thousands are fleeing the city. At this point, matters very much is the military success, and that is shown by the fastness of the past weeks, how close they get into the center, how close they get into liberate, finally, Mosul.
This battle has been going on since mid-October 2016, meaning now it's about 5 months. The Iraqi forces have devoted huge numbers of soldiers, and they have air power support, of course, from the United States, and thousands of U.S. Troops, special forces are in Iraq. Many have also been assigned to more frontline positions, at least in a support capacity, according to the Pentagon. Why is it taking so long? Let's talk about what the equilibrium or disequilibrium is in between the two sides.
Well, to start with, it was very easy for Daesh, for ISIL militants to take over Mosul in the first place in June 2014, when they found no resistance. And funny enough, they were for over 500 miles in broad daylight going through the desert, and no American satellite could actually get them. But as I say, it was actually quite easy for them. It was hardly any resistance. And most of Iraqi troops fled the city, leaving thousands and thousands of this militant terrorists take over the city. They have taken the city and they have converted Mosul and the capital of Daesh in Iraq. They created an infrastructure that is very strongly involved in the population. And as I said in the first place, they're using hospitals, they're using schools, they're using every single delicate, sensitive target as a base of operations. So this is costing also very much the troops to take over positions where they believe it might be full of civilians that could be used as human shields. I believe as fast as they, in the past weeks, they're getting into liberating Mosul, they're trying to also be very careful because the amount, the percentage of civilian casualties is skyrocketing at this point. Daesh knows that if they lose this position, they might lose a very important part of their caliphate, not just in Iraq, but also in Syria, mainly in the whole region. So I think that they're fighting till the last drop of blood to be able to keep that city, which is also very rich in natural resources. And it's definitely, after losing Aleppo in Syria, the militants lose also Mosul. They will be very much in the end of total defeat.
Why was the Iraqi army so... Well, again, not defeated in June 2014. I mean, they had 30,000 U.S.-backed and trained Iraqi military forces in Mosul. It was just a small number of thousands of Daesh militants who, you said, across the desert in the open and somehow were able to defeat 30,000 soldier-strong Iraqi army because they didn't resist. They just fled. I mean, was that the commanders? What was going on there?
I think in the first place, they were actually taken by surprise. They didn't get the warning from, as I said, the American satellites could have probably warned the fact that there's, in total, there were around 7,000 insurgents took Mosul. And the way that the behavior of these militants, just at the entry of every single town. I was in Syria 1.5 years ago, the last time, and it was when one of the cities that eventually had been liberated by Al-Qaeda-linked groups. And actually, they operate in the same way. First thing they do is they catch every single man or every single kid over 14, and they decapitate them at the entrance of the village. So that provokes that most of people flee the place, and actually, like what happened, over 25,000, 30,000 Iraqi troops just fled, leaving all the weapons behind, leaving all the armor, leaving everything behind. There were a few thousand casualties, but nothing in comparison with the amount that just left. Nobody understood how could that happen, that 7,000 people could take over, well-trained by Americans, with weapons given by Americans, tanks and all sorts of high-tech weaponry. So what basically was provoked is this fear that these people inflict anywhere they come in. I think this is actually what provoked that all these thousands of Iraqi soldiers left in a way that it was not expected, but it wasn't expected in the first place that this a small number of militants will go for such an important city, probably the second most important city in Iraq, and take over just in few hours, if not in 48 hours. I think the whole city was under the control of the militants. I think that the Iraqi troops were taken by surprise. They were not well prepared. They were well equipped, but they were not well prepared. And that's why they left behind this.
Let me just ask you, though, just to stay with this for 1 second, not that this is the main story, but what about their commanders, though? I mean, there was a lot of talk about the Iraqi command structure, again, trained by the Americans, getting a lot of American money, had in fact been very, very corrupted. In other words, they weren't really ready for battle. Their positions were sort of payola, you know, political awards or awards of one type or another for their fidelity to the government rather than the fact that they were, you know, real military leadership, or is it that the troops themselves defied their commanders and just fled out of terror in the face of the ISIS brutality? Just for another minute, just talk about what you think on that.
No, actually, the commanders were not doing properly their jobs. The commanders were also taken by surprise. And as you very well said, I mean, we're talking about administration at this point. I think it was Nouri al-Maliki. This is a puppet government, a proxy government by the United States. It's heavily corrupted, the administrations, the army and everything. So this would not surprise me that the high commanders actually were very much involved. And as a matter of fact, quite a few of them were displaced to other areas, punished by the government. It was actually a shame. It was actually an embarrassment because the equipment that they had and the training that they had by the Americans could have made anyone believe that they would have been ready enough to repel such an attack. But the way that it was done also reminds me the Nazi attack on France, where they actually circumvented the Maginot Line. They enter through Belgium into Paris without shooting a bullet in hours. And this very much, I think, it's an example very clear also for what happened in Mosul. And ever since, it's been very, very difficult to recapture Mosul. Militants have become extremely strong in the city. It's been rather difficult to get in. As you said, from October on is where the big offensive started. They're not just Iraqis. They're Iraqis involved. The Kurdish militias, we should not forget about them. The Peshmergas, and we should not forget about the Iranians that are at this point also fighting in this offensive to recapture Mosul. But definitely commanders, the high commanders, were not really ready for this. There were real embarrassment. And, of course, the soldiers, seeing the way that the commanders were the first ones to flee the area, they just did the same.
Right. We're speaking with Alberto Garcia Watson. He's a journalist and former senior Middle East correspondent for Hispan TV. You've talked about the fact that ISIS or Daesh, so-called Islamic State, is strong in Mosul. Is it strong because it has a popular base of some kind? Of course, there was the dissolution of the Ba'athist Iraqi National Army by edict of the U.S. occupation forces in 2003. That left, you know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of military men unemployed. There's been a lot of talk about that they were a part of and an important military part of ISIS strategy or recruitment. Is that part of why they're strong in Mosul, or is it something else?
Well, to start with, Mosul is not a Shia city. It's not even that heavily populated by Sunni, like we will say in the Anbar province with Fallujah and Ramadi. This area is very, very highly populated by Christians, and the Kurdish were very interested in also taking over. What actually could have made these people so strong there is what made them strong also in Raqqa. Get a position heavily defended and have a rotation of thousands of militants coming and going, put in a law on Christians to pay a heavy taxes to be able to live in the city or otherwise die, and then impose the regulation and the Sharia in the way they understand Sharia, which has nothing to do with this people has imposed on the city of Mosul, which is a distorted view of Islam, which is the Wahhabism that has been imported from Saudi Arabia. So what made them so strong there? I think first it was the interest of the Wahhabist militants, the terrorists, in having a city first, that it was very rich in oil, that they could actually trade with that oil through Turkey. We have very good evidences that even the family of Erdogan, his son Bilal Erdogan, was trading with the oil that ISIS was selling from Iraq and from Syria to Turkey to be then sold to Israel and other nations and the European Union. So Mosul had obviously a very, very important interest for the terrorists to keep not only that, but the fact that it was actually also a very strategic position for the militants, also in order to direct operations into Syria. As a matter of fact, when the Americans got involved in October, the offensive, they were talking about leaving a passage, a free passage, for the terrorists to be able to move into Syria, into Raqqa, which it has been happening anyway, back and forth, because actually the same people in Raqqa that are in Mosul, they're the same militants, they're the same with the same ideology, even the same, if we would say, Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, or any of these groups, are actually the same ideology, the same basis into creating a caliphate and impose, as I said, the distorted point of view of Islam brought from Saudi Arabia. Mosul, it was very important for them to keep it. It's still very important for them. They're still fighting every single street. They don't want to give up Mosul, because if they lose Mosul, and eventually, as we see very soon, Raqqa will be the next offensive, they're going to be stripped from the most important positions.
Yeah, so a very, very important period in history, in the history of ISIS, short-term history in Iraq and Syria. In the last minute, Alberto, it's striking to me the contrast in media coverage, at least here in the United States, over the liberation of East Aleppo from the same or similar forces, same Wahhabism, same armed terrorist organizations. Everything that happened in East Aleppo was considered a war crime by the Syrian government or the Russian government. It sounds like in Mosul, again, the same sort of forces fighting it out with each other, but in this case, the Americans are involved as allies of the Iraqi government. And there's almost no coverage at all about this humanitarian catastrophe that's befallen the poor people of that city, that very, very large city. How do you explain it? We have about 30 seconds. The difference in media coverage.
The difference is a very basic difference. It's very, very similar, as you very well said. This is very important cities. The second city in Iraq was Mosul. It's Mosul. The second most important city in Syria is Aleppo. The difference is that the agenda was a different one. Regime change is most important for the West and for the United States and get rid of al-Assad. Is not the case in Iraq. As I said, they have a puppet government there. They have al-Abadi at this point that is serving the interests of the Americans in Iraq. But al-Assad is not serving the interests of the Americans. It's not serving the interests of the Europeans and the West. It's not serving the interests of the Gulf nations. It's serving the interests of its own people. So it was very important for the West to show the tragedy that the civilians were suffering under the bombardment, under the siege that they were suffering. But it's not that important in Mosul, where actually we see a tremendous tragedy with people fleeing by hundreds of thousands, a famine that is affecting, and people dying by starvation. It's even worse. But there we just hear about the great military successful battles won by the coalition led by the United States, which was not important in Aleppo.
Yeah, some lives seem to matter more for the political narrative spun by the mainstream media here in the United States and in Western countries. I totally agree with you. It's truly disgusting. We've been joined from Spain by Alberto Garcia Watson. He's a journalist and former senior Middle East correspondent for Hispan TV. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The Trump administration's budget outline proposes devastating cuts if they get their way. The burden of the huge Pentagon boost will fall squarely on the back of the working class and poor in the United States. Massive cuts also in science, the arts, and environmental protections. We'll talk about this with Anoa Changa. We're talking to Anoa from Atlanta. She is the editor-at-large with the Progressive Army and host of the weekly radio show, The Way with Anoa. Welcome back, Anoa. Anoa, if you're a poor person in the United States, if you're part of the more than 150 million people who have to go to work every day to live, this budget may not be very good for you. Talk about it.
Oh, where to begin? From comments from members of the White House staff saying that poor single mothers should not have to pay for PBS, which has been influential for generations of children to learn and get additional wraparound supports and other things. I mean, you have there's so many different agencies and smaller funded projects that are on the chopping block. And while they're small and only very small percentages of overall government spending, they do provide such crucial functions for so many areas of the country, including areas that did vote overwhelmingly Trump. We look at, for example, the two that stuck out for me just off top were the Appalachian Regional Commission and the Community Safety Board. The Appalachian Regional Commission serves, projects and is a federal state partnership in Appalachian communities, which ranges from the southern part of New York all the way down to parts of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia area. So that's a huge area in the state of West Virginia, which we just saw McDowell County, the poorest county in America, in a town hall with Bernie Sanders. It's smack dab entirely in the middle of that region. He wants to get rid of Community Development Block Grant Program under HUD, which actually works in conjunction with the Appalachian Region Commission to distribute some of the grant programs and stuff to some of the local partners that work on all different types of reinvestment and other programs. But apparently Community Development Block Grant Program also sponsors and funds things like Meals on Wheels, which provides needed nutritional assistance to so many people across the country, right? So, I mean, when you look at this, I mentioned the Chemical Safety Board, while it doesn't have real teeth, it provides recommendations after chemical-related disasters that have then led to further public involvement in education to take steps to address issues. For me personally, that was experienced. I experienced Chemical Safety Board direct involvement in the 2014 West Virginia water crisis, where the Chemical Safety Board had previously made recommendations for what was called Chemical Valley in that area of West Virginia that had been ignored by state legislature, but it gave the public tools to actually be able to hold people accountable. And then they just released another report from that investigation before. So there are so many different things that directly help support community and engagement for low-income, working-class, poor people across the country that he is deciding to slash in part to help pay for his wall and the other parts of his budget that have been deemed making America great while gutting, opportunity and access for so many people.
It really is very revealing. I felt from the beginning that when the Trump cabinet was picked, the Trump personnel team was picked, and then the Trump budget was unveiled, we'd have a real sense of what the Trump government really stands for. And what it seems to stand for is deregulating a business. It means lowering the tax rates for the already very, very rich and for corporations. In other words, lowering their already minuscule contribution to the national budget. And then transferring wealth, really, because this is what it will mean. If you're giving money to the already rich and taking money from the already poor, if you have this Robin Hood in reverse, what we see emerging is a government of looting. In other words, looting the national treasury to pay Wall Street. I mean, that's really what it was. Let's go over the items about what's going on here. The defense budget goes up, and I would say defense is a misnomer. The war budget goes up by 10%, $54 billion. The wall that you talked about, the so-called wall at Mexico, which Trump said they will pay for it, well, actually, this budget increases $2.6 billion to build a wall. They're going to have to allocate a lot more money than for more ICE agents and more immigration agents and more money for prisons because these are very remote parts of the country. And then another $1.4 billion increase for what they call school choice, which means taking money away from public schools and giving it to private for-profit schools. That's what's going up. going down by 31% is the Environmental Protection Agency, the Agriculture Department 21%, Labor Department 21%. These are all down. For Health and Human Services, down 19%. Education down 14%. I mean, there's already this huge education crisis in America. So what's the answer? Let's cut the budget for education. Go ahead.
I mean, absolutely. And when we're looking at, you know, and people might just look at these things and not understand what we're really talking about here when you're talking about providing education and services. I saw someone, not just with this, but also when you have this budget and then you also parallel with it, the need to, well, not just the need, the focus, determination to undermine, even though the ACA itself has its own issues, but this new healthcare plan that's supposed to make America great that's been proposed and shuttled through, there's so much overlap, because when you look at something like defunding the Department of Education and the potential to children with disabilities and other special services, and then you look at the new Health Care Act and some of the services and concerns that are provided for children with autism, for example, right? Like, this stuff cannot just be looked at. It's already bad enough on its own, but when you look at with other priorities that are being made across the administration, like you were saying, it really tells a very it tells a picture of what's coming forward and where we need to start directing our energy and efforts. But one point that I wanted to go back to that you made, this robber baron syndrome, like it's literally robbing from the poor to give to the rich. I mean, it's taking from the neediest programs without discrimination, just asking things and not even paying attention to what they exist for. HUD is down as well, despite, you know, concerns for rental assistance allegedly being increased. Overall, HUD is going to be down, which will disproportionately impact the ability to even provide rental assistance across the country to different people. But like you were saying, though, Brian, too, when you look at the choices for people who have been put in these positions, it just seems like that ultimately the goal is to not just deregulate, you know, the government, but undermine its efficiency for anything other than helping to make businesses more profitable. I mean, increasing the defense budget goes straight into the increasing, you know, profits for the defense industry. It's very clear, like, where things are going in that respect. And it's, when you look at, like, slashing the EPA ag business, that directly affects, you know, hardworking, everyday communities. And there's so much focus. Like, I was listening, I read some comments from, like, Senator Schumer, and everyone's talking about, oh, the middle class. As we've all discussed previously, the middle class is dwindling, and you have this huge section of Americans, you know, different gradations that are just struggling so much. So this picturesque middle class that people have envisioned that they're trying to protect, that language really needs to be abandoned, and we need to start looking at dealing with issues of poverty and issues affecting working people all across the country, because this is exactly who Trump and his administration are coming for, not this imaginary notion of middle class that goes up to $250,000 that Democrats often speak of.
Right. So you have the defense budget going up 10%. I didn't mention Homeland Security, 7%. Of course, building the wall, that's another $2-something billion, but that ultimately will be about $15 billion. When Donald Trump says he's going to make America not just great, but safe for working class people, and as you said, working class people feel insecure, not really because some other country is about to drop a bomb on them or necessarily because of terrorist actions. They're insecure because so many people can't make ends meet. I mean, literally cannot make ends meet. One out of every two Americans is either poor or near poverty, according to the government's own statistics. So what the Trump administration is saying basically is, we're going to cut your services more. Your wages are already down. You don't have full employment. You maybe have some underemployment. You can't really afford drugs. You're going to be cut out of your health care program, probably. We know now that more than 20 million people will lose health care. As bad as Obamacare is, 20 million will lose health care according to the Trump plan. But guess what? We're going to put a lot more police and a lot more prisons and a lot more law enforcement agents into working class and poor communities, as if that's going to do anything other than lead to greater mass incarceration. So what makes a family secure in America? I mean, that's the question that begs to be answered, I'd say, right now when we see this budget. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, going back to his favorite place of Chicago, right, that he loves to talk about Chicago. But when you think about one of the programs that will be will be decimated is low-income heating assistance. I mean, look at places like Chicago, like Milwaukee, like Buffalo, that have you know, high rates of poverty, you know, high rates of unemployment in communities of color, and you know, people rely on these types of benefits and stuff. You know, putting poor, I mean, like basic. This is like the most basic thing, like heat, you know, rent, having a place to live, food. These are the most basic necessities for human existence. And he's talking in these fanciful terms that really ultimately do not appeal, even though they may appeal to a certain sensibility of people in some places. At the same time, when we really just start talking to people about the issues and what's at stake, like choosing this false notion of security and being kept safe when that's not really, you know, the greatest concern, like you just said, for many people across the country. Over, you know, daily life, or they pick these other hot button topics, like even with the notion when he was trying a couple weeks ago to they want to create an office to track legal undocumented people who kill other people or whatever it was he was something really crazy like that he was trying to do, and so it's like that's not that it's not an issue. It is not the issue that needs hyper government focus on it. There are so many other things that really need to be talked about. And when we're looking at already with the EPA and the cuts to the EPA and the disproportionate exposure of communities of color to particulate matter in the air, higher incidences of asthma and other exposure. And then again, going back to West Virginia, a place like West Virginia, like I talked about, but you've had issues with Dow Chemical and so many other organizations, Bayer, and high incidences of things like different types of autoimmune diseases and cancers and things like that. I mean, another thing that's on the chopping block in terms of its funding is the National Institute of Health. The National Institute of Health, while only I think about 11 or 12% of it's a low amount that's actually internal research, but it funds a lot of research, you know, at universities and other institutes to do, you know, to study different diseases and cancers and things like that. Like for my family, it's very personal, as my father is just now getting out of the hospital with a rare form of cancer, which I was doing research because we were trying to know more about it. Some of the research that's led to some of his treatments has been directly funded by the National Institute of Health. So what was fatal 17 years ago for my grandfather is now treatable for my father. So there's so much right now that's put on the table with the Trump administration. And this is not even like the full-blown budget, right? We still haven't seen what he plans to do to Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and things of that nature that directly impact our everyday lives. And this is where Democrats fail. Democrats fail because they spend so much time worrying about Trump's taxes or Trump's not a nice person. Who cares? Like talk to people about the issues. If there's an opportunity to really organize, engage, and do anything about what's happening right now, it's getting to people, it's getting to the quote-unquote Republican base and pointing out and showing how what's happening right now is fundamentally going to affect everybody in a not a good way either, unless you're a part of a certain echelon with a particular portfolio that might get a boost from the increase in private prisons, the increase in defense industry funding, et cetera.
I couldn't agree with you more. The liberal establishment and the Democratic Party have harped so much on Russia as another, I'd say, diversion in order to show how, I don't know, that they're like the old Reaganite Republicans. Of course, here you have all of these real issues that affect real people in real communities who don't care at all about Russia. I mean, not that they shouldn't care, but, you know, the whole meaning the U.S. foreign policy towards Russia. But they don't care about this nonsense from the Democratic Party that somehow Trump is the president because of RT or Sputnik or fake news or hacking. I mean, people just don't go for that. The Democrats continue to fail. They continue to fail in terms of mounting a real resistance. There is grassroots resistance, but it's not – the Democratic Party resistance is not, from my point of view, real. This budget, as you've said, Anoa, it abolishes programs that provide low-income Americans with help on virtually all fronts, including affordable housing, banking, weatherizing homes, job training, paying home heating bills, obtaining legal counsel in civil matters. I mean, so many different areas that are being cut. But will this be the budget? Because obviously, the Republican Congress people, many of whom are extreme right wingers and just ideologues of a particular type, but they also have to run for office. A lot of the working people, the poor people, the families who are going to be devastated by this budget, they won't look kindly on those who support the Trump budget. I mean, do you think that within the Republican Party, in the Senate, in the House, that there will be formidable opposition to this? Will this be the budget or will it be turned around by Congress? We have 1 minute. About 90 seconds.
without public outcry and without more than just the usual suspects showing up, I mean, people really have to start connecting. The same way Bernie Sanders sat down and had conversations with people at the town hall, we got to have conversations with people regardless of what they registered as, right? And people need to, because representatives represent everybody in a jurisdiction, not just the people who voted for them. And people really need to make their voices heard and make sure they're loud and clear. So there is a potential, because people need to get reelected. They want to get reelected. They want to at least be able to try and say they did something. And that is the one bargaining chip I think that American people have in terms of this potential budget sitting in Congress. Some of this will probably, you know, go forward, but there's going to be the Republicans are going to have to be forced a little bit farther away from that. And I think that only happened with people demanding it and taking it straight to them, and not just, again, you know, progressives and hardcore leftists. It's going to have to be involving people who consider themselves more right-leaning and Republican, who are working class, who are directly impacted by these issues. I mean, we got to organize people. That's just the most basic thing, I think.
I hear you. And of course, according to the U.S. Constitution, the power of the purse lies only with Congress. Trump's proposals are proposals. Congress ultimately has the responsibility, and also Congress can make shifts. So let's see if there can be really intensified grassroots resistance. I think there will be. I think you're right about that. We're out of time. We've been joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga, editor-at-large with the Progressive Army and host of the weekly radio show, The Way with Anoa. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.